Everybody, we are resuming our study of Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. And where we are in this section of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is beginning his discussion of the three major categories or dualities. And he has begun by talking of Brahman and Maya. That's where we are right now. If you recollect, before that, there was a section in which he talked about the three kinds of properties by which Brahman manifests itself. So the first one was variability. The Brahman is one and infinite. And hence, it can remain one, but it can also deploy its infinity and do so in infinite ways. Not only in a kind of a temporal variation, but simultaneously at the same time. So that's the first major property. The second property is of self-limitation and self-prospection. That means that in all these various ways in which Brahman can explore its infinity, it can actually limit itself. In other words, it can enter into each one of these as a name and form of itself. These forms of self-prospection, in other words, becoming its own self-limitation, cause all its infinite properties to coexist as forms of Brahman. Brahman itself is all these things. The whole of Brahman is all these things. The third property is exclusivity of concentration. What that means is that it can not only stand behind each one of these and become all these infinite properties simultaneously, but it can enter into each of these and lose all the others. It can be, as it were, exclusively each of these. So these three properties are utilized to make a number of universes or cosmoses, whatever it may choose to deploy. And whatever manner it may choose to deploy these three major forms of its operations, yield its various manifestations. Now, then Sri Aurobindo goes ahead to talk about what are the ways by which these are deployed. So one way by which this is deployed is the Brahman-Maya relationship. Brahman and Maya, or as he says, Brahman standing in a position of self-prospection behind each of its infinite possibilities as Atman, is free. It is that poise of the one infinite being that can remain one and that can remain static, that can remain completely free and completely unexpressed, and yet that can remain, as it were, supporting its own infinity. So one may say that this infinite one, in its primary mode of manifestation, doubles itself. It becomes simultaneously one infinite being that is not deploying its infinity and one infinite being that is infinitely deploying its properties or qualities. These, in other places, Sri Aurobindo calls the passive Brahman and the active Brahman. Using the Vedantic formula, these may be called Brahman and Maya. So the relationship between Brahman and Maya is one in which they seem to be two, but they are one, simultaneously existing, and one is completely free of the other. One seems to be totally without any concern for the other, and it is possible to enter into that one and become, as it were, exclusively unborn. Never even come into any manifestation, that which has never come into any manifestation. On the other hand, it is also possible to know that one as the supporting power behind that other part or, aspect of itself in which its qualities are manifest. if one knows it in that particular way, then one always sees that this witness being, this one that is static, is in relation. It is constantly, its existence is premised on a relation with its other self-manifestation, that of its force, that is becoming all things. This Bayun being, this being in which the one is always in relation with its own infinity, is Purusha-Prakriti. That's why Purusha-Prakriti have to be always seen together. In the way in which we experience Purusha-Prakriti, we find that Prakriti is something which is separate from Purusha, active as a variety of laws in the cosmos, and Purusha as conscious being is taken along, as it were, for the ride by all these variety of rules and laws by which the cosmos manifests itself. However, Purusha can find that it can become independent of this action, but even in independence, it is tied to this action. It is tied from the viewpoint of having power only to refuse sanction. And if it refuses sanction, then it separates itself and Prakriti falls into abeyance. It falls into quietude. So the two are codependent. Purusha and Prakriti cannot be completely free of each other. So that is another kind of relation between these two realities. Later, Sri Aurobindo will introduce the third reality to which he gives the greatest importance. That is the reality of Ishvara and Shakti. That is when the Purusha becomes clearly aware of the fact that not only is it free of Prakriti, but that is it is master and lord of Prakriti. That in fact, it itself has become Prakriti. That there is the one that has become the two and can enter into the two, into its own double and control it. Can change its laws, its determinations. So this is how we connect back to the original premise with which he started, which is how do you relate freedom and determination in the cosmos? Brahman is always, as Atman, Brahman is always and eternally free because unborn, not even manifest. Its infinity is always infinitely potential to it. Brahman is also constantly and always in self-manifestation, because at the same time as it is infinitely free, it is all infinitely determining itself by every possibility of self-manifestation. So these two realities are then related one to another, and this relationship is also a relationship that can change depending on the amount or degree to which Purusha has allowed itself to be subject to Prakriti. At its heights, it is completely free of Prakriti and lord of Prakriti. At its depths, it is completely ruled by Prakriti and only enjoying whatever Prakriti does by a implied consent. So this is where we are. Interestingly, these ideas and these terms that Sri Aurobindo has introduced in a way encompass an enormous history of Indian spiritual thought. These terms or terminology belongs to three layers of Indian spiritual thought. Purusha and Prakriti may very well be one of the really early ones, at least maybe as old as the Brahman-Maya relationship. It belongs to a layer called Sankhya. And the paragraph which we will begins by talking about Purusha Prakriti as having been created by Sankhya. Sankhya is a kind of an empirical formulation of our of consciousness and force. Empirical in the sense of how do we experience it in our existence, everyday existence. We feel that we are constrained by a number of laws, and these laws move from the laws of inconscience in matter to laws of relative consciousness. We find that there's laws of life, life vitality has also got its own kinds of laws. There are laws of thought, laws of logic, and laws of conditioning of the mind and of the life, which are considered to be laws, unlike in the Western tradition where the mind is considered to be somewhat free. So nature, which is composed of laws or determinations, is encompassing all these matter, life, and mind. So we find that that which is conscious in us is outside of these. And if we are to actually try to locate that, we find that in each individual, there is a certain point of transcendence. It's interesting that modern Western philosophy has tried to make an approach in this direction through what is called phenomenology. The founder of modern phenomenology is Husserl. And Husserl had a similar intuition in that he's talking about what he calls the transcendental ego. For him, the transcendental ego is something which transcends the operations of our activity and of the world. So he's saying, what is the real? To arrive at what is the real, we have to bracket off our experience of the world. In other words, we don't take that for granted. We see that the experience of the world is actually something that is given to us and we agree upon because our will is intentioned in certain ways. We receive the world according to how we handle it, and we handle it according to how our common consensus makes us understand our common being in the world. This is what he calls the life world. So the life world engages our material, vital, and mental existence through our will, so that the world makes meaning to us as a consensual agreement. But outside of these is something which is the conscious being, which can only observe how the will acts in this consensual interaction. And that freedom is the freedom of what he calls the transcendental ego. Now, original Sankhya is very similar to this, because original Sankhya believes in many Purushas and one Prakriti. So many Purushas meaning each one of us is an independent witnessing point. And it does not try to resolve that into a single conscious being. That is where its empiricism ends. Later what happens is that the Gita comes along and modifies this Sankhya. In fact, if we look at the Gita as a political text, as a text of discursive politics, then we'll see that actually the Gita is trying to answer Sankhya, because perhaps Sankhya had, by the time of the Gita, become very important. And it is trying to do that by constantly, you'll see the character called Krishna in the Gita is constantly saying, this is what is said by Sankhya, and this is what is said by Yoga. And what he says regarding what Sankhya says is a modified Sankhya. He takes the original Sankhya that we just discussed and he actually complexifies it further. And he makes it look as if that which we are calling actually not makes it look. He makes a very logical conclusion that which we are talking of as many Purushas is only an illusion of many Purushas because of one of the properties of Prakriti, that is Ahankara or ego. Because ego exists, it fragments as if the one Purusha into many reflected Purushas. So if we were to overcome the ego, we would realize that not only is there a transcendental ego, that is the one each individual Purusha, but that there is one Purusha, there is only one Purusha, that is the cosmic Purusha, that is manifesting itself through the fractured lens of many Prakritic egos as many Purushas. See, that is how Gita deals with this problem. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that there is one step, other way of understanding this, and that is the relationship between Ishvara and Shakti. Purusha and Prakriti is a kind of an inert way of looking at the power of consciousness and the automatisms of consciousness. But if we look at Vedanta and the third, actually, so Brahman and Maya belong to a system of thought called Vedanta. Purusha and Prakriti belong to Sankhya. And there is a third system of thought, which is Tantra or the Agamas. The Agamas are the system of thought that believes in the gods. Now, each of the gods, like Vishnu, Shiva, the various gods, have each their own texts called Agamas. The Tantras deal with the Devi, the goddess. These are all the beings with forms. But beings with forms are only self-limitations of Brahman. It's, as we saw, the second property is self-limitation. It's self-limitations of the one that has no limitation. And as gods, these gods are self-limitations which at the same time know themselves to be the one without any self-limitation. See, that is the differentiation between the gods and other creatures, in which the third property of exclusive self-concentration makes them forget that they are all the others at the same time. See, so we find that Ishvara is the supreme being, Brahman, Purusha, as the Lord, as the one who is in relation to the cosmic force, as the master and lord of the force. That is also present in Prakriti, because Prakriti itself, that seems to be an automatism of consciousness, has consciousness implicit in it, which has allowed itself by its own law, its own self-determination, to act in the way in which we find it as Prakriti. If it were to decide to act in another way, Prakriti's law would also change. This is a very important point for Sri Aurobindo, because eventually what he's after is not the acceptance of the world, but the transformation of the world. To transform the world, its self-determinations must be changed. Not that its determinations must be changed by some other power, but the self-determinations must be changed. In other words, we must know that all the laws that operate in the cosmos are actually laws of the one being who has trapped himself in those laws. And he can undo those laws and become something else. Now, this point he will make through the rest of this section. And at the end of it, he will point out that the power by which these things act is the dynamic power of Brahman, active Brahman, which can be called Maya, which can also be called Shakti, which is what he calls the Divine Mother, is that aspect of this infinite being by which it has come into existence through the operation of laws. And it is that power, that doubleness of Brahman, that can only undo those laws and create new laws. That's why we come back to what Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is premised on: surrender to the Divine Mother. You will see that he will come to that point in this chapter as well. So I think with that we can, unless there's some questions here, we can proceed. Are there any comments or questions at this point?
Could you repeat why you are saying that the premise of surrender to the Mother helps with the problem of, the universe being able to self-determine? Like, could you repeat how the two are related?
I could explain that a little bit, but I think it's better we wait, because, he hasn't yet introduced the Ishvara-Shakti relationship. As we go into those paragraphs, you'll see that he'll make it much clearer. At this point, he's pointing out that this Brahman, which is the one infinite being, which is unmanifest as Atman, as self, has itself become the active Brahman. The passive Brahman and active Brahman are the same thing in passive and dynamic forms. They seem to be two, because we think of two as different from one. But as a matter of fact, by its own power of self-variation, it can coexist as two forms of itself, you see. So that which is the force of Brahman, which is active, and that which is unborn as the infinity of Brahman, that is latent, of these two, it is the force of Brahman that exists in an unequal relationship with us, because we are trapped within the force of Brahman. Therefore, it is Brahman as force, Brahman as mother, Brahman as Shakti, that can take us back to Brahman as unborn Lord and give us that power of will of the Brahman by which the self-determination of Brahman in the cosmos can change. That is the reason why it is the active aspect of Brahman that becomes the key to both the freedom and the sort of transformation of self-determination.
Thank you, Vishwasa.
We realize that in some ways it's sort of quite interesting. I mean, if we contemplate it, that we exist in the world in a kind of unequal relationship with space and time, unequal relationship with being and becoming. Being, space, a kind of, like we can conceive of a eternity, something which is eternally still. But we cannot conceive of a time which is mobile both in one, both directions. We are sort of stuck in the arrow of time. There is an inequality to that. In terms of space, we can conceive of going very high up and looking at everything through a single glance. That's why we talk about God's eye view. But can we talk about the single becoming of God? We can't even conceive of it properly because we are already tied to a becoming which is linear or which has a certain kind of sequence to it. So this is the reason why force and the power of becoming are something that we are much more constrained by. And it is only that whatever is becoming that can loosen the bond and make us able to change its laws. Until that time, we can either get out of it into a transcendence, which doesn't include it, the transcendence of the Atman or Brahman, or we can have a nominal degree of freedom where we just allow Prakriti to do whatever it does within its own laws, but in our inner being, we are free, and we are watching the Prakriti do whatever it is doing, which is the Gita's solution. What Sri Aurobindo is giving us is one step further. He's saying it's possible to change the rules of the game. And to change the rules of the game, you have to become that which has become the game. It's the most audacious idea possible. And he's proposing that in this work.
John Robert, would you like to read?
Yes, thank you. In the philosophy of the Sankhyas, we find developed most thoroughly the metaphysical idea of Purusha Prakriti. These two are eternally separate entities, but in relation to each other. Prakriti is nature power, an executive power. It is energy apart from consciousness. For consciousness belongs to the Purusha. Prakriti without Purusha is inert, mechanical, inconscient. Prakriti develops as its formal self and basis of action, primal matter, and in it manifests life and sense and mind and intelligence. But intelligence too, since it is part of nature and its product in primal matter, is also inert, mechanical, and conscient. A conception which sheds a certain light on the order and perfectly related workings of the inconscient in the material universe. It is the light of the soul, the spirit, that is imparted to the mechanical workings of sense mind and intelligence. They become conscious by its consciousness, even as they become active only by the assent of the spirit. The Purusha becomes free by drawing back from Prakriti. It becomes master of her by refusing to be involved in matter. Nature acts by three principles, modes, or qualities of its stuff and its action, which in us become the fundamental modes of our psychological and physical substance and its workings. The principle of inertia, the principle of kinesis, and the principle of balance, light, and harmony. When these are in unequal motion, her action takes place. When they fall into equilibrium, she passes into quiescence. Purusha, conscious being, is plural, not one and single, while nature is one. It would seem to follow that whatever principle of oneness we find in existence belongs to nature, but each soul is independent and unique, soul to itself and separate, whether in its enjoyment of nature or its liberation from nature. All these positions of the Sankhya we find to be perfectly valid in experience when we come into direct inner contact with the realities of individual soul and universal nature. But they are pragmatic truths, and we are not bound to accept them as the whole or the fundamental truth, either of self or of nature. Prakriti presents itself as an inconscient energy in the material world, but as the scale of consciousness rises, she reveals herself more and more as a conscious force, and we perceive that even her inconscience concealed a secret consciousness. So too conscious being is many in its individual souls, but in itself we can experience it as one in all and one in its own essential existence. Moreover, the experience of soul and nature as dual is true, but the experience of their unity also has its validity. If nature or energy is able to impose its forms and workings on being, it can only be because it is the nature or energy of being. And so the being can accept them as its own. If the being can become lord of nature, it must be because it is its own nature, which it had passively watched doing its work, but can control and master. Even in its passivity, its consent is necessary to the action of Prakriti, and this relation shows sufficiently that the two are not alien to each other. The duality is a position taken up, a double status accepted for the operations of the self-manifestation of the being. But there is no eternal and fundamental separateness and dualism of being and its consciousness force of the soul and nature.
So here we find that Sri Aurobindo is giving us the philosophy of Sankhya of Purusha Prakriti, Purusha dash Prakriti as he calls it, in a kind of a composite manner. He gives it to us in terms of what Sankhya says. Then he also introduces, without mentioning it particularly, the Gita's modification. And then he adds a third element, which is the agamic understanding or the tantric understanding of this relation. So firstly, he talks about this, the way in which Sankhya presents this relationship between Purusha and Prakriti, the Purusha being the conscious being and Prakriti being the various laws of nature by which whatever experience we find ourselves partaking of is created in the cosmos. These experiences belong to both all three components of matter, life and mind. Now, in Sankhya psychology, you don't really find that division into matter, life and mind. That is more like a Vedantic concept. The Vedantic concept in the Taittiriya Upanishad shows that each of these, what we call, what Sri Aurobindo calls physical, vital and mental existences, and then beyond the mental, the supramental, the bliss. The Taittiriya Bhrigu's Tapasya chapter goes up to bliss and it stops there. But all these are not really addressed directly in Sankhya. Sankhya talks about what it calls the inner instrument, which is the Sanskrit term it uses as the Antakarana, which Sri Aurobindo actually equates with purely the mental being. It is the mental Prakriti that contains the senses, the sense mind, a certain kind of sensational intelligence, intelligence of sense, then a mind of sense, and an intelligence of free intelligence, the Buddhi, and the ego, Ahankara. Now, according to Sankhya, actually the ego is subsidiary to the intelligence. The intelligence comes first, then comes the ego. But of course, the Gita will sort of reverse that and make us see that the ego is one of the primary evolutes of nature of Prakriti, which allows Purusha to get fragmented and then seem to have an independent will, when actually there is only one being. So Sankhya introduces, where Sankhya sort of tacitly agrees with the Vedantic division into matter, life and mind, is in its modes of Prakriti, its modes of gunas. So as he points out over there, the automatisms of Prakriti operate due to the relationship between three kinds of modes of Prakriti or gunas. These are called tamas, rajas and sattva. So tamas is the inertial quality, rajas is the active quality, and sattva is the luminous quality. Now all these act in our being. So we actually are experiencing a kind of a part of our being or our psychology which is more static, inertial, does not want to move. A part that is constantly driving us with its blind mobility, forces of mobility, volition, and a part that is casting the light of understanding on whatever it is that we are doing. Now, each of these has a certain kind of sentience to it. It has like the sensations and senses and all that has a certain, the intelligence. We seem to feel that they are all conscious. But Sankhya will say that they are not really conscious. They are just the relationship between these modes of Prakriti inside which Purusha is trapped. And by the fact of its own consciousness being trapped within this, it imparts a kind of sense of consciousness to these things. But actually they are not really conscious. So if we can think about the operation of pure tamas in our psychology, that would become the physical being. If we can think of the action of pure rajas, it would be the vital being. If we can think of the action of pure sattva, it would be the intelligence or buddhi. And if we can think of the relationship between these two, between these three, then we can think of a vital kind of a rajas and a sattva acting within the physical being or within the tamas. We can think of a sattva and a tamas acting within the rajas or the vital being. We can similarly think of a tamas and a rajas acting within the sattva of the mental being. So they are all in relation. Depending on the greatness or less, you have a more stagnant mentality or a more active physicality or whatever. All these are constantly the automatisms under various combinations of relation between these three modes of nature. The consciousness in all these three cases is the borrowed consciousness of the Purusha, according to Sankhya. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that there are two deficiencies. He says this seems to be a good explanation when we look at it empirically, as I was pointing out. So that's why he's saying that it would seem to follow that whatever principle of oneness we find in existence belongs to nature. Well, that one we already talked about. Souls are independent. Then he says, all these positions of Sankhya we find to be perfectly valid in experience. When we come into direct inner contact with the realities of individual soul and universal nature. But they are pragmatic truths, and we are not bound to accept them as the whole or the fundamental truth either of self or of nature. In other words, this is how we experience the world as an individual. But that is not the last truth of reality, either of the self or of nature. Prakriti presents itself as an inconscient energy in the material world. But as the scale of consciousness rises, she reveals herself more and more as a conscious force. And we perceive that even her inconscience concealed a secret consciousness. So here he is modifying the classical understanding of Sankhya by saying that Prakriti is not just a bundle of automatisms that are operating through the relationship of three automatic modes, but that is how we experience it due to the nature of the scale of consciousness in which we find ourselves. As the scale of consciousness rises, we realize that Prakriti is also conscious. Prakriti, down to its most unconscious and inconscient level, is a formation of consciousness. So this is again one of the modifications of Sankhya that is introduced in the Gita. That is why Gita talks about Prakriti as derived from a certain all-conscient active Brahman, active form of the divine, which it calls Para-Prakriti. Gita, therefore, is something that takes Sankhya but connects it to Vedanta and to Agama. Gita is a theistic text. So to it, the highest reality is the divine person, Purushottama, who has embodied himself as the person Krishna, and whose force or active energy is Para-Prakriti, that has become what we call the automatisms of nature or Prakriti, that seem to be unconscious automatisms, but are fully conscious in the form of active consciousness. And as the scale of consciousness rises in Prakriti, we will discover that. The other modification that he introduces is in the second sentence after that, where he says, moreover, the experience of soul and nature as dual, so too conscious being is many in its individual souls, but in itself we can experience it as one in all and one in its own essential existence. This again the Gita is saying, as I said, by saying that it seems to us that each of us is different. But if we actually go out of the ego, we see that there is only one being that is formulating itself as the many. Moreover, the experience of soul and nature as dual is true, but the experience of their unity has also its validity. Here he is going back to Vedanta, where he is talking about the one Brahman that has become the two. If nature or energy is able to impose its forms and workings on being, it can only be because it is nature or energy of being, and so the being can accept them as its own. We live not only in the becoming of being, but in the relationship between being and becoming. Hence, it is being that becomes. It is being that is in becoming. And hence, it is not a duality, but it is something which can modify its own self-becoming. This is a very important point, and that's why the last part of this paragraph is that which makes us transition from the idea of the duality or even of the power of Purusha as witness over Prakriti to the power of Purusha as the Ishvara or the Lord or being that is in becoming, the one who is in the becoming. So he says, if the being can become Lord of nature, it must be because it is its own nature, which it has passively watched doing its work, but can control and master. Even in its passivity, its consent is necessary to the action of Prakriti. And this relation shows sufficiently that the two are not alien to each other. The duality is a position taken up, a double status accepted for the operations of the self-manifestation of the being. But there is no eternal and fundamental separateness and dualism of being and its consciousness force of the soul and nature.
So is there a reason why he's spending a lot of time backgrounding, comparing and contrasting with Sankhya and Vedanta before he delves into his own theory? The first question. And second is, it doesn't seem that he's directly mentioning the Gita here, whereas in your summary you've been speaking about it. Is there a reason why we need to consider the Gita also? And if so, why hasn't he done that?
Yeah, well, to answer your first question, why is he spending so much time on this Purusha Prakriti of Sankhya and then the whole idea of Brahman and Maya, etc.? I believe that is partly because that's how we experience the world. That was the utility of Sankhya, and that's the reason why it became so important in Indian philosophy. Because we experience the world as if we are conscious beings in an unconscious world. And so we don't experience, our empirical experience is not of one being. It is an experience of separateness. There's on the one hand the notion of independent separateness of each individual existence. And on the other hand, the notion of a duality between something that is conscious in each of us and that either has degrees of unconsciousness in the world, or is a single unconsciousness that is ultimately something we are being forced to deal with. It's the thrownness, the idea of being thrown into a medium that is alien, and we are dealing with it. So it's that alienation of consciousness in the world, and on the other hand, the separation of the individual in the world that become the empirical pillars on which Sankhya has been built. And that is our normal experience. So it's sort of in a way important for Sri Aurobindo to address that, you know, because otherwise it becomes a speculative philosophy. He's starting by saying that that's what makes it, what I used that term earlier, transcendental empiricism. It's a transcendental empiricism because it starts with an empirical experience. And then what he does is from there he's looking at the way in which consciousness does not need to be seen like that, that there is another way of looking at consciousness, and that there are other experiences in which this relationship and this multiplicity is resolved into something else. And what can be the relationship there? Because it is very, one may say, even anti-intuitive. If you go to somebody like your question, say, for example, why doesn't he start by talking about his philosophy? If you were to go to somebody on the street and say to him, you know, you can change the whole world, not just by doing some social activism, but by meditating or by changing yourself, you know, they think you're crazy. So he has to start from the empirical basis, from that move on to talk about the relationship as one which gives us a provisional freedom. Freedom from nature, to show that there is another status in which we can be totally free. We can be the one, not the one among the many, but we can be the one, and we can even be the one that has become the cosmos. So remember, the first chapter is talking about freedom and determination. It is the self-determination of the one that exists in every one of its determinations. And therefore, each one of its determinations can change the self-determination of the one. That is the premise. But it's a very big, bold premise, and he has to take it in chunks and show us. Moreover, that's one answer. The other reason would be that we are dealing with the baggage of centuries of Indian philosophy. And so he has to address that to some extent, because again, in spite of all that Sri Aurobindo has written, the majority of even those few people who deal with Indian philosophy do not accept him, because they think that there is greater safety in the accepted traditions. So they will not stir out. But if one reads between the lines and really sees, not even between the lines, I mean, if one reads the lines, one sees how he has addressed all those positions and then come to his position. So that is the answer to that part of your question. Then you had a second part.
Just to finish that. Yeah. Our day-to-day experience, when we say that, is like when we experience ourselves as separate from the Prakriti, but that is the ego experience, right?
Yeah.
When the Sankhya is talking of this many Purushas and one Prakriti, do they mean the same thing, that Purusha, when they say those many Purushas, do they mean the same thing as what you use the word Ahankara, the same ego, or are they talking of, is Sankhya talking of a different experience of...
No, it's talking about, I was trying to make the comparison with Husserl and saying that there is a transcendental ego. It's talking about a transcendental ego. The Purusha that it is talking about as an independent individual Purusha, which is not the one Purusha there is, but sort of tied to each individual, you know, is like a transcendental ego. It is separate from the Prakriti, but still it is not universal. It is tied to the individual. So it is not our ordinary experience, but our ordinary experience intuits it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how the whole intuition of Sankhya begins. Each one of us feels, well, we are conscious beings. But where is the consciousness located? Then it says, well, you can't understand where the consciousness is located because it's all mixed up with your Prakriti. Separated from the Prakriti, and you will experience it as a separate conscious position that is independent of the Prakriti but individualized. That's what it's going about.
Sure.
So, yeah. Now, you had a second...
The second question, which we can get to it later too, was there isn't an emphasis on the Gita in this, but
Yeah, that is, I think, only incidental. I mentioned it because, I'm also kind of pointing out, I'm reading between the lines.
Sure.
I'm trying to point out what is connected. But I think because the Life Divine is not the essays on the Gita, so he's actually kind of talking about these things in a purely philosophical manner. He's not showing those, developing those historical links.
Okay.
In the Gita, in one point, Krishna also makes a comparison between Sankhya and Yoga.
Many points. He constantly makes that.
So that kind of way of dealing with philosophy is what Sri Aurobindo is also presenting here. Right?
In a way, because you
so
see...
This is the next step.
Yeah, so you could say that's why I raised the question. Why do you think the Gita is doing that? I think the Gita is doing that because the Gita is coming in as a Vedantic text. After an interlude in which these philosophies called Sankhya and Yoga have become very prominent.
And by yoga, you mean Patanjali's Yoga?
No, I don't mean Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which is a much later text and has nothing to do with what Krishna is talking about. It's a big mistake that people make.
Right.
It has nothing to do with what Krishna is talking about. It does have something, a little bit to do with what Krishna, that it does, and it's, I think it's second chapter, you know, in the Yoga Sutra. Where it's talking about surrender to the Ishvara, Ishvara Pranidhana. That is the one element of Yoga Sutra. Yoga Sutra is a mixture between an older yoga system and the Sankhya system. And yoga system is basically teaching a kind of karma yoga based on surrender to the Ishvara.
So when Krishna talks about yoga, is he meaning this? This karma yoga?
Yes, he's meaning karma yoga.
And it was just called yoga at that period when Krishna
was talking. It was works through surrender to the Lord. That's what it is. So idea of Ishvara and Shakti is already present in this yoga system. Idea of Purusha and Prakriti is already present in Sankhya at the time the Gita is being written. But later these things have changed. Sankhya has sort of retained its character through things like Sankhya Karika and also what we call Yoga Sutra. While yoga has more or less morphed and become only a little part of a chapter in the Yoga Sutras and really only exists in its original form in the Gita.
And do we have temples dedicated to Sankhya yogis?
No.
So right now, who are the practitioners of Sankhya?
Loyola Marymount University and Chris Chappell. No, sorry. What I meant to say is that it's become very popular now. A lot of people follow Sankhya Yoga through the, you know, your disciplines of this Yoga Sutras and things like all these various, if you go to one of these yoga studios, if they're not focused entirely on physical yoga, if you ask them what is their principal text, they'll tell you it is Yoga Sutra. So they're actually following Sankhya in a sense.
Why is Sankhya called Sankhya?
Sankhya literally means enumeration. It means to enumerate. So Sankhya is basically saying, let's start enumerating the things that are not consciousness. And those things will be Prakriti. What you'll be left over is the residue which cannot be named, and that is Purusha. That's why it's called Sankhya.
What did you exactly mean by transcendental ego?
By transcendental ego, you see, because when Gita is approaching the problem of many persons, which belongs to Sankhya, it is saying that the many persons is not really true. It's not really true because the Purusha is still under the power of the, one of the powers of Prakriti, which is the Ahankara or ego. So long as the ego is still there, a shadow of the ego is still there, under which Purusha is still subject, then we have the sense of being an independent Purusha. But if we can get rid of that ego, then we know that there is only one Purusha. So if we can think about a Purusha that is under the power of ego, then we are basically talking about a transcendental ego. Ego which has transcended the power of the Prakriti. The rest of the Prakriti has been transcended, but it is still like a kind of a bare, conscious, you know, ego.
So basically the separation which makes it many is the ego part, which is... But the reason why it is transcendental is because it is not bound to Prakriti.
Correct.
It's, yeah. Okay. So basically, what is the goal then? To remain like that, not to be bound, to remain as a transcendental ego and not to be bound by nature, but still remain as many. Is that the goal of Sankhya?
That's the goal of original Sankhya. Yes, that is the goal of original Sankhya. In which case, you see, there are some schools that develop out of that. Jainism develops out of that. Because Jainism is saying that the world is, universe is plural. Each individual will ultimately become totally free of Prakriti and exist as a, so, almost like an independent universe, just a witnessing kind of, you know, point in the universe. So in other words, it's retaining its sort of, you know, envelope of independent ego, but it is free of everything. Gita has modified Sankhya, and so later Sankhya is not so clear about this point. And even in the Yoga Sutras, I think there isn't that particular definition that we are just talking about. That there is a sense that we can transcend that, separateness of the Purusha and become one Purusha, that the only Purusha there is.
So, maybe we are already proceeding in that direction. I was about to ask, if they believe in any kind of one, which is, I mean, if they don't, then what is the origin of Prakriti? Who created the Prakriti?
So according to Sankhya, Purusha and Prakriti are original and uncreated. In other words, just like you can talk about Brahman as something which is uncreated, according to Sankhya, there are two things that are uncreated, Purusha and Prakriti.
So, it's like two as always.
Yes.
Two and it's never one.
Never one. Never one.
Yeah, thank you. That answers my question. It seems that then in that case, if correct me if I'm wrong, that Advaitin has closer to Sri Aurobindo's theory than Sankhya in that case, right?
Yeah, ultimately you may say that, you see, the Advaitin is, the Advaitins are saying that there is only Brahman and the world is false. So they are reducing it to one. But there also they are left with a duality, because if the world is false, then still the world has to be admitted and then falsified, as it were. So, you know, the problem is that I think with Advaitins, from a certain point of view, you can say that what Sri Aurobindo is also doing is resolving everything to an Advaita. But that Advaita is something which is inclusive of the Prakriti, inclusive of the world, inclusive of the force of the world. For Advaita, there is no force. They are only kind of managing to say, well, there is Maya, but Maya is mysterious and they don't know what it is. So they are also actually left with the dualism that they are only wishing away, but that they are not really resolving.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not supporting it. What I mean is that at least it has a structure, meaning it starts with, it has a start, in other words. It has a beginning, that one, and then then the illusion was created out of it, like Maya, whatever, and then you just get out of, you sort of discard it as an illusion and then go back to your origin.
Yeah.
But Sankhya, it seems that it's more counterintuitive that way.
It's counterintuitive in terms of if you're looking for an origin to creation, which is one. But it is intuitive if you think that our experience of reality is the primary kind of way in which things have always been. Mm-hmm. You see? You may say that looking at a single origin creation is something more intuitive. Maybe yes, maybe because these guys will say that is because the property of the mind is to look for a single origin, because the mind's property is to look for exclusive realities from which things begin. But if we look at it as we experience the world, the experience of the world is always a duality. We see dualities everywhere. So why not assume that there has always been duality? And they have a theory of evolution also. Their theory of evolution is that this duality has always existed in relation. And due to that relation, Prakriti is evolving. They have a theory of evolution that it is developing forms of Prakriti that are closer and closer to Purusha. And so intelligence or buddhi becomes that property of Prakriti that is like a link principle between Purusha and Prakriti. It's the highest power of Prakriti. Now, if you take it one step further, you can ask the question that does Purusha possess intelligence? And that becomes another way by which Sankhya sort of connects with Vedanta, because buddhi then becomes vijnana. Buddhi of Purusha is vijnana. And that is, of course, supermind. But Sankhya stops short by positing that Prakriti is evolving these various kinds of entities that are closer and closer to Purusha.
So, if that is the case, that means that it started at some point.
Yeah, it's the evolution of Prakriti started at some point.
Okay, so what is that point?
That point is, they call it mukhya. In other words, that is inconscience. That is when everything is in tamas. As he's saying that if sattva, rajas and tamas are in equilibrium, then there is no creation. So that is the original state. But that compound of sattva, rajas and tamas in contact with Purusha achieves a disequilibrium. That disequilibrium causes the evolution of the separation of these three, sattva, rajas and tamas, their mutual relation and the evolution to begin.
So basically there was a beginning of the state of nature, which was more unconscious or inconscient, than a later state. So if that is the case, when was the time? How was that time selected? By whom?
There you got me. I don't know. That is something they don't address.
That's what I'm saying. It's less logical. At least, if you think of illusion, of course, there are also many questions will remain unanswered in case of Advaitin.
Yeah.
But at least a singularity, even in, physics, a singularity is something, the most intuitive way of explaining why the standard model includes Big Bang. So without singularity, we can't explain anything, in fact.
Yeah, but they are not into explanation beyond a certain point. They are kind of like all these schools, they say that certain aspects of our experience are extraneous to reality. You know, all of them, that's where the limitation of all these schools, because at some point they say such an answer, such a question, that question does not exist as far as reality is concerned. It's only an epiphenomenon of human existence. So for these guys, they can fall into two or three positions. One of them is repeatability, right? So in other words, when did it begin? It began many times. In other words, that they can fall into the theory of yugas, that it always has begun. In other words, there is always a point where this kind of system gets into disequilibrium, and there is always a point where it stays in equilibrium. So it's keeping on repeating itself. These evolutions keep on repeating themselves.
Okay. So basically they believe in the eternity of a cycle.
Eternity of, yeah, of cyclic becoming.
Okay. I mean, it sounds more like a convenient way of sort of bypassing the problem.
Well, it may seem to some like that, but it became very important, and actually it pervades the whole of Indian philosophy, partly because of its empirical basis. It is ultimately, you may say, that they created, and why is Sri Aurobindo talking about it at all? Because it's a convenient way not only of explaining things, but it's a convenient way of approaching reality. We experience reality like this. And so with that which is conscious and that which is not so conscious have to be put into relation, and consciousness as must experience its freedom. Ultimately, in all these philosophies, the first step is to experience the freedom of consciousness. And this is one empirical method of doing that.
Well, the cycle, when it is not beginning by itself, because this is an object of the cycle, not the subject of the cycle. So that means it is being controlled by something else, the cycle itself. Basically, it seems the cycle is superior than the object of the cycle.
By object of the cycle, you mean Purusha?
Prakriti, that which is evolving.
Yeah, that which is evolving is okay. It's evolving, but Purusha is trapped in it. You see?
Yeah.
So Purusha can get out of it.
Nature is trapped into the cycle, meaning it is bound to cycle.
Yeah.
And Purusha is trapped into nature cycle. So basically it's like double trap.
Yeah, so that, I mean, it is a kind of a, so that's why he's saying it's a pragmatic truth. It is a truth of, I mean, it is not the, a kind of a theory of creation does not hold up too well. But, you know, one thing is, I mean, your question is valid, but what I'd say is that one thing is the Indian tradition has not considered, well, what you're talking about is philosophy, which is actually trying to give an explanation for the cosmos. Indian philosophy has not concerned itself primarily with giving an explanation for the cosmos. Its primary concern is with the experience of freedom. So its explanations, or basically its theories, have been pragmatic theories. All its theories are pragmatic. Ultimately, we can derive some kind of explanation from Vedanta, but it has not started to try and do that.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, I got the answers of my questions.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
The ability to arrive at a single understanding of the cosmos and its origins is a kind of a sort of a relatively modern a trend. It arises with the what is called the Enlightenment. That's the whole idea of Enlightenment, to arrive at one explanation. That's why we are so concerned, and we think that that is what man should always have done. But human beings have not done that always. That has not been their concern always.
Armchair philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, to arrive at a proper, something, a cogent, a coherent explanation. That is a relatively modern thing.
So, the Pashidha in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, when they're having this discussion, Gargi and Yajnavalkya, at some point she asks a question and he says, I cannot answer to you because if I do, then that's going to make your head explode. So, is there a sort of a learning out there that there are some questions that cannot be answered to the mind, to the intellect? Because of
that question ultimately is, you know, actually that is a very interesting question, because that is similar to what Keka was asking, which is, what is the origin? If there is a duality, what is behind the duality? That is the nature of that questioning. So ultimately he comes to Brahman. Mm-hmm. And then she asks, well, then who created Brahman? That's when he says, you cannot ask anymore. If you ask anymore, your head will fall off. And that is understood in a variety of ways. One is that, you know, Brahman is it's the cause, uncaused. There is no cause to Brahman. I mean, that itself is say something like, in Western philosophy, they call it the absolute with a capital A. There has to be something uncaused, you know. So to try and understand that, mind has to disappear. That's the idea about the head falling off. So that can be any philosophy.
Yeah, but that uncaused is basically the singularity uncaused, not a dual uncaused.
Yeah, but then that's the thing. I mean, who is there to say that there isn't a dual uncaused? See, that's the whole point. I mean, in the Indian tradition, they have allowed for the possibility that there could be a dual uncaused. It's only our mind that is asking for a singular uncaused. And it isn't always the human being wanted a single. It is also a relatively modern thing.
Could also be a bias from our own learning for many years.
Yeah. Basically, it, of course, depends on what we are referring to as duality. But rather, mind is, compelled to live in duality, because without subject and object relationship, mind cannot comprehend. But I think it's just the aspiration of the mind to get out of that duality, and be thinking that I have a master somewhere who is singular and who derived my duality. It's like the singularity, which actually is not comprehensible by the mind, because mind lives in the dualities. So it seems to me that these dualities are more convenient ways to have pragmatic, as you pointed out, pragmatic explanations of the reactions and responses. But singularity is something that is just it puts mind into silence, that, you know, everything is possessed by something superior.
Yeah, I agree. But this tradition is not giving that much importance to mind. Remember, mind is only an aspect of Prakriti. Mind is not supreme. Mind is something which is already erroneous. It's a kind of it's prone to its own types of biases. Now,
yeah, I mean, I was not talking about, just because there was a discussion about this mind's understanding about singularity and etc. But what I try to point out is that singularity is something that is actually beyond mind.
That's okay, but it's only the mind that demands it. Other parts of the being don't demand it. It's intuitive to the mind because it's looking for that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the mind's intuition is correct. It may not be the only thing there is. So what Sri Aurobindo answers it in such a way by talking about vijnana and by talking about it in a way that satisfies the mind. But in these schools at these times, it wasn't that important. I mean, it wasn't seen to be the primary thing.
So intuition is not conceptless. But it also is has a balance, a much different balance. And I think in my experience of studying Iyengar Yoga, in which he draws very heavily on the sutras, but goes beyond them, and he talks about training the buddhi to get into all of the cells. So. And it almost sounds to me like the yoga of the cells that Sri Aurobindo talks about.
So what you're talking about, Joanne, again, to kind of connect the notion of intuition, there can be many kinds of intuition. The mental intuition is a certain type of intuition, but there are other types of intuition as well. And this is also following a certain type of intuition. It's the intuition of the duality of the universe at every level, not just at the mental level. And for them to come to this particular conclusion that there is an eternal duality is a certain way of addressing that. Now, what you're talking about regarding intelligence, because according to this school, intelligence is the highest evolute of Prakriti. And so intelligence is implicit, according to them, to all the other evolutes of Prakriti. In other words, the cells, everything else has got a certain intelligence. Now, the intelligence that they are talking about over here, is that's why I asked the question as to whether intelligence belongs to Prakriti or is intelligence ultimately that of Purusha? Is it that which actually links Prakriti and Purusha in a way in which Purusha can understand Prakriti? Now, if that's the case, then we actually move into Vedanta again and talk about Purusha as having qualities and nature which is of a higher type that includes intelligence that actually validates the mind. You see, then we again come to a unity. And in fact, I mean, though Sankhya is spoken of as a duality, if we look at how Sri Aurobindo deals with it, he sort of reads between the lines and says that we can read a kind of unity in Sankhya itself. And there are scholars who have done that. Now, he's saying that what you're saying about using the intelligence to go into the cells, ultimately, if the intelligence we are talking about is high enough that it actually masters Prakriti completely, then it is possible to do that. That intelligence is what Sri Aurobindo is calling vijnana. In other words, that is supermind or supramental intelligence. But the intelligence that is the human intelligence cannot have enough control over these, because though they are saying it belongs to Prakriti, ultimately the Prakriti is only a kind of a provisional sort of reality. All its properties are coming truly from Purusha.
So I'm thinking, my reading of what I've read actually points to yoga as the joining of the buddhi with the cells.
Yeah, but by yoga you mean what? The kind of Patanjali yoga or yoga Iyengar yoga? What do you mean
yoga,
by yoga?
Which is based on Patanjali, but it's not the same.
Right.
And he's written a book on the Yoga Sutras that's heavily, heavily annotated, where he reworks the Sankhya theory in it. And then one of his last books, what is it called? Light on Life.
Yeah.
He talks about the buddhi being the goal of the yoga, being to bring the buddhi to the cells. And he's not talking about the mind, he's talking about the intelligence itself. And he addresses that, and when I've been there, I can sense this also. They address the practice there as bringing the intelligence to the cells as well. And it's not mind. It's a much deeper intelligence.
Yeah. So I've heard others say that as well. I mean, in fact, I'm in dialogue with one person who is saying exactly what you're saying. Well, what has happened is that the Sankhya that we are talking about over here is the original formulation of Sankhya. And today, whatever we get of, say, from Iyengar or even from the Gita onwards are various modifications of that, which are already including Vedantic concepts. And to what extent they're using Vedantic concepts is unclear. So when we say buddhi does not belong to mind, but is greater than mind, that is not something that Sankhya would have supported. But already belongs to something like talking about a realm of consciousness above whatever we experience as Prakriti.
So it seems like an evolutionary concept, because he's talking about changing the buddhi and moving the buddhi and bringing it to, as a yoga to the whole being.
Yeah. So that's exactly where, people can talk about these types of properties and use them to some extent. The question is, there becomes a question of many different pictures of reality. How high is the buddhi? Okay. Because, if you think about sort of cosmic mind and levels of cosmic mind, say Sri Aurobindo would say that there are various levels of buddhi, but even up to what is called overmind, that buddhi is not capable of fully penetrating into the reality of matter. That's why he's talking about the golden lid that has to be broken, and you have to emerge into supermind to use that particular power. And that's why in his seven quartets, Vijnana Chatushtaya is the solution to the body, Sharira Chatushtaya. Without that, you don't have that buddhi. And those who have not been able to give the taxonomy of buddhi in those terms, they leave it in a kind of nebulous way. We are just talking about buddhi, but we don't know where it's coming from. So we have to see the gradations of buddhi, and we have to be able to give it a clear sort of, know exactly how the buddhi is rising from plane to plane to a plane which is adequate to the body. See, all the other forms of buddhi are not adequate to the body. Now, if he's talking about that, then we really don't know, because he hasn't given us that taxonomy.
You mean if who's talking about it?
Iyengar.
Iyengar, okay. And I have to go look back again, because he gives it a lot of discussion.
Yeah. How many kinds of buddhi are there? What are the gradations of buddhi? What is adequate to the body? Of course, we can say mental buddhi as we know it is not adequate to the body. But what other type? You know, that's the reason why Sri Aurobindo gives us all these planes above the mind, and each one has its own power. But none of those have enough power over the body until we break through to the vidya, to the supermind.
Look, interesting.
Okay.
Just quick question. Since we discussed so far, the Sankhya, did they deal with the term? I mean, reality, like whatever we understand as reality, like there is one reality or something like that.
For them, reality is Prakriti. There is one Prakriti. And there are many kind of, like let's say if a materialist sort of definition talks about consciousness as an epiphenomenon of matter. So the matter becomes reality, right? And then matter produces many different phenomena, and ultimately you have something called consciousness. That consciousness lasts only as long as matter lasts. When the body is gone, there is no consciousness left, right? So according to these guys, you have Prakriti. Prakriti has got, Prakriti has got Purusha associated with it. Then when the Prakriti dissolves, then Purusha remains. It, so long as it is caught in the kind of cycles of rebirth, it will be forced to take other bodies, but ultimately it can separate itself and become a witnessing center. Whatever we experienced as reality was Prakriti.
I see. Okay. Now I think I have I got it a little better. So Purusha is something that is housed within Prakriti. It doesn't have any existence outside of Prakriti.
No, it does have existence outside of Prakriti. It is housed within Prakriti, you are right. But because it is potentially independent of Prakriti, ultimately it can get out of Prakriti and it can, then Prakriti does not exist, only Purusha exists.
So basically, as you pointed out, that reality is Prakriti. So if it has to get out of that, that means it has to get out of reality, meaning it will stop being real.
Yeah, true. It will stop being real. Absolutely. It will stop being real. And that's why if you notice that paragraph, he hyphenates Purusha Prakriti. That means if one drops, then there is the other does not exist actually. If it exists, then it is not, I mean, there is the, whatever reality was is no longer there.
Yeah, interesting. It's again, intuitively it feels that, okay, that reality is the consciousness which is sort of holding it together. And so that's something which is superior to both this multiple Purushas and one Prakriti that is determining all the creations and the entire flow. It seems that way. I mean, otherwise.
Yeah, you are still insisting on the kind of unity that is transcendental, that there should be a singularity, right? You are insisting on that because you are actually holding on to the intuitive correctness of that. But that's what I'm saying.
The reason why I'm saying it is that whether they actually implicated that without explicitly mentioning. I mean, sometimes some of the things, like for example, in Buddha's case, some people take it total as atheism, like non-existence, but it could mean that it was beyond the existence as we know it. So there is a little disclarity of what he exactly meant. So similarly, if Sankhya actually originally implicated or had that inside, but laid out it this way in a dual way? That is what I'm trying to figure out.
We don't know. We don't know if that's the case. It's unlikely that it's the case. Most of the explanations of Sankhya ultimately fall back into a radical duality as the origin of whatever we are calling reality, actually. You know, that there is a original duality to it. I mean, we can keep talking about whether there is an intuition of singularity or not, but the duality is what they thought was true, you know. I mean, that even today there are philosophies that believe that duality is true, you know. So we don't know whether duality is true or not. I mean, why
actually,
should we insist on
that the Shiravinda also has, I mean, duality is intrinsic within, as I mean, in Shiravinda's theory also, duality is eternally true as well as the singularity. So the duality is within it. What I mean is that it cannot be singular. That is another, I mean, it's exclusively dual, and the duality as a property, one of the possibilities, are two different things, right?
Correct. But duality as an exclusive possibility is also a possibility. Duality as an exclusive truth is also a possibility. So that is what they are holding on. You see, ultimately, what is reality is something that we don't know until we experience it.
We are all speculating. Given where we are, I think it might be better to stop and read the next paragraph next time.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll stop here and we'll start with the reading of the next paragraph 2 Saturdays from now.
Are we at the same time in the next 2 Saturdays?
Yes,
okay. So that'll be, looks like 9th May. 9th May, and we'll convene at 7:30 Pacific time on Saturday.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay.